You're listening to The Fringe Impact, How to Surf the Public Exchange Risk Adjustment Wave Without Being Caught in the Undertow, presented by Julia Lambert and Karan Rustagi from Wakely Consulting Group. This session was presented February 2017 at the Risk Adjustment Value Visit.
So now we're going to kick off to our next session. So I'm delighted that we have Wakely with us today, and no pressure, but Julia is one of my favorite presenters. Because whenever Julia presents, and I know that she has Karan with her today, and Karan, I haven't heard you present yet, so the pressure's on.
First time for everything.
Right, the pressure's on. So, Julia, do I understand correctly, you used to be a teacher in a previous life? Okay, that explains so much, because after Julia's done, I usually feel like I almost understood the math that time, right? So it's really gratifying. So I hope you guys enjoy it. Last year, Julia came to this conference, and she broke down the formula for us, and I know that a lot of the folks in the room who are actuaries, and so they, of course, were all nodding along, like, yes, oh, I understand that. Not me. I was shaking there going, no, I don't understand it. But a lot of them took that back and used it to help the conversations that they have to have internally, that probably many of you have to have internally, right, when you're having to explain the logic behind some of the math that you're showing to your executive. So it was a really great tool just internally for that education purposes. So we asked Julia to build on that this year and talk a little bit about the unintended consequences, which we brushed over in the last session. There was a lot of fallout with the way that the formula has been set up and executed. And so kind of talking through that and then extrapolating that forward into the decision making that everyone's working through right now.
Thank you to Health Plan Alliance for inviting us to speak with Allison's overview yesterday of some of the risk adjustment on the Medicare side and sort of how we're helping plans with that. Today we're going to talk a little bit more about the ACA, but really appreciate the opportunity to speak with this group. Kristen has been so kind to invite us back, so appreciate that. And along with Allison's comments that she made yesterday, this is an awesome group. I mean, it's really inspiring, and we're just happy to be part of it. So I'm Julia Lambert. I am a principal with Wakely Consulting Group and a consulting actuary. I'm from just down the road in Tampa, where our corporate office is. I'm joined today by Karan Rustagi, who's out of our Denver office. So a little bit about Wakely. This is our new logo, Ooz Oz. We introduced this for the first time earlier this year. We are moving away from our old logo, which was a little bit rigid, maybe old school, to a little bit more clear, concise, maybe a little more casual. We think that's who we are. Maybe we're even trying to be hip. That's a stretch for actuaries. This is our new W logo. The tail here, this is a nod to our nerdiness. Anybody know what the tail is in reference to? Come on, there's a few people. Shane from Pulse 8, are you here? Come on. Mew, thank you. So there's a Greek letter that starts like that. So that's just a nod to the formulas that we like to get into. So that's Wakely. All right, so here's our agenda. And before I get into that, yes, the teacher is going to come out sooner rather than later. I want to tell you about why we think we have a say or we know something about risk adjustment. So there's two big projects that are out in the marketplace that you may have heard of, but it really is giving us the insights that we have to bring to you today. So there's two projects. The first one is this, affectionately known as WinRAR. Anybody in the room heard of WinRAR before? Good, a few of you. So for those of you who haven't, this is Wakely National Risk Adjustment Reporting. So Wakely National Risk Adjustment Reporting. Boy, I better get that right. So this is the project that we started back in 2012 with the industry to capture diagnoses for the ACA marketplace and off exchange, capture diagnoses for the risk adjustment payment transfer formula. So we get the diagnoses and we report back to the plans what their risk payment transfer is going to be, or we at least try to estimate it. So we do that on a approximately a quarterly basis. So in any given calendar year, so 2017, we're collecting that data from plans. We're giving the plans back an estimate of year-to-date, what does the payment transfer formula mean to them, and then also trying to project, well, how's the rest of the year going to impact that payment transfer formula? So we do this for 35 states. In each of those states, we have about 80% of the market. So we have a very deep understanding of the payment transfer formula because of this work. So that's WINRAR. The next one, yeah, we should have gotten the PR marketing people involved a little earlier when we started doing these projects. So the next one is WRINR. Yeah, in some circles I've even heard it called RINR. That's a hard one to say. But so they're very similar, and they often get mixed up, confused. So let me tell you a little bit about this second project. We've been doing this not as long, so starting last year. What that stands for is Wakely Risk Insights National Reporting. Wakely Risk Insights National Reporting. So what we did is we asked the participants in WINRAR if they wanted to give us more data. So as part of WINRAR, we only get the diagnosis data. As part of this second project, we actually get the EDGE data. So we get all of the claims detail, enrollment information. And what we do with it is we run our Wakely Risk Insights program on it. And what that does is it identifies the performance drivers in your data. So what is driving profitability? Is it a network? Is it a hospital system? Is it a set of PCPs? Is it particular plan designs? Is it people with certain diagnoses? So what happens is we collect all of that data. So first thing, which is a big lift, is we convert all of the EDGE data into something we can use. So we put it in a database, and then we run this Wakely Risk Insights on it. A side benefit for us that comes out of that is we get a big de-identified database of basically the ACA and off-exchange, or the exchange and off-exchange marketplace. We believe we have one of the most robust data sets available for understanding this marketplace. And we're starting this project again for 2017. We're actually collecting the 2015 data now. We have about 30 plans who are going to participate this year. And that data set is going to give us, the new one, is going to give us over 2 million lives of data, potentially up to 4 million. So we're still trying to collect that data and see how robust it is. But as we move into health reform and trying to understand what policy is going to impact and how, you know, which members are going to be affected and how plans are going to be affected, this data set is really exciting for us. We have a lot of hope, and we're partnering with policy folks and different associations to use this data set to help the industry understand what the new policy is going to bring to the market. So WRINR, if you haven't participated, it is free. So it's closed for this year, so keep it in mind for next year. But if you're a participant of WINRAR, you got invited, please look for it again next year. Again, you have to sort of make an agreement that you're willing to allow your data to be put into this de-identified data set. But assuming you do agree to that, then you can have your data run free of charge through the WRI program back and present it back to you. So those are the two projects, but they both give us a lot of insights into this market. And so that's why we're here today. I'm going to talk about the payment transfer formula, and then my colleague Curran is going to talk a little bit about what this second project, some of the insights that it's bringing us and we're bringing to health plans from that national data set. So, yeah, I thought it would be a bad flashback, so I don't know if it's true or not. But last year, I'm in Albuquerque. I went through a lot of details regarding the payment transfer formula. You're going to get it again, sorry, in advance, but at a little bit more higher level, because this is going to set up some of the things that Curran is going to talk about. The payment transfer formula, hopefully it's not the first time that you've seen it, but hopefully this will give you a little bit of better understanding or maybe just a refresher on what this darn thing does. So this is how they calculate the risk adjustment payment transfers. There's really two main things that this formula does. One is it compares how you stack up to the rest of the market. So there's the you versus everyone else component. And then the second component is what kind of risk you're getting versus what kind of premium you're getting. So I use this very technical term, left-hand side, right-hand side. So left-hand side, right-hand side. And I like to concentrate within the brackets because the P on the outside is just premium. Okay. So left-hand side, this is really the estimate of the claims that you should expect based on your risk score. And this PLRS, you can look down below, but PLRS, that really is risk score, plan liability risk score. So on the left-hand side, you have, among other things, you have your risk score. And it's your plan liability, so what the plan is expected to pay based on the risk score of the membership. What risk you have. On the right-hand side, think of this as the premium you're allowed to collect. So left-hand side is the risk you got. The right-hand side is the premium you can collect. So what are all these things? Actuarial value, you can rate for that. Age, you can rate for that. Induced demand, you can rate for that. And a geographic cost factor, you can rate for that. So the right-hand side is what you can rate for. So the left-hand side minus the right-hand side is what risk you're getting that you can't, so you subtract out of that, what premium that you're getting back into the plan. So if you have higher risk than the premium that you're collecting, what happens? You get higher risk, so you have sort of worse experience than your premium rates would say. You're going to get a positive amount, and you're going to get money back into the plan. You're going to get a receivable. If you have a risk score that's lower than the premium that you can collect, you're going to have a negative amount. So you got good risk. You got healthy people. So the inside the brackets is going to be negative. You got good risk. You're going to have to pay, right? So, so that's the risk you get versus the premium you can collect. That was one of the main important concepts. The other main important concept is how do you compare to the market, right? Because it's not just about you. It's how you compare to the rest of the industry in your market. And that's the top versus bottom, very complex term. Top is all about you. The bottom, there's this summation thing here going on. Summation is just saying compare you at the top to everyone else in the market. So the denominator, if you will, is just comparing you to everyone else in the market. And so that's how you guarantee that this is a zero-sum game. So it's the real high level, but gives you a little bit of a flavor of what the components are trying to do. There's a couple other important things here that I want to talk about. One is this I. So you do this for every I. So what is I? Is I a member? Do you do it for every member? Do you do it for every health plan? Do you do it for every market? Do you do it for every plan design that you offer? Any guesses? Or it's none of those, by the way. I shouldn't. Does anybody know?
Do you do it for each individual in your market area?
It's not at an individual level. It's actually at a metal tier and market. Metal tier and market. So for each metal tier and market, we do this calculation. So let's say we're in Region 1 in Florida, and there's 5 plans, 4 metals. Well, we won't talk about catastrophic. 4 metals. So 4 metals, did I say 5 plans? Thank you. So you do it for each metal and each plan in that market. So 4 times 5, you do it 20 times for that Region 1. And then so on across the market. So you do this formula a lot, but what ends up happening is you never see it at that level, right? You see it just all combined. What's plan A got, issuer A got for a payment transfer? So when you get into the guts of this thing, you're doing a lot of calculations, especially when you got, you know, dozen issuers in any particular market. So so it's a lot of calculations, but keep in mind it's not at an individual level. So you have this internal formula, or this internal bracket that's doing it at each metal tier and market, but it's not at an individual level. So there's a lot of plans out, or sorry, a lot of vendors out there who are doing things similar to WRINR, RINR. This is, again, showing you the profit drivers in your business. It's based on member-level profitability, and you'll hear that a lot. You talk to any vendor, you're like, oh, I'm looking at my member-level profitability in the ACA. So one of the things they have to do is they have to take this payment transfer. First of all, they got to look at it by market and metal, and then they got to sort of parse that out to the member level. So do you do that a PMPM? Every member is the same? Probably not, right? Because every individual's got... You have a risk score for every individual. So we have an algorithm that takes that PMPM and says, oh, you've got a high risk score relative to your market, so we're going to give you more payment transfer. So if you're talking member, so here's the key for all of you. If you're talking about member level profitability, start asking, how are they allocating the payment transfer out at that member level? Makes a huge difference and actually can drive a different result at the end of the day. So just a word of warning, be careful. So that's I. Another concept that I wanted to talk about in regard to the payment transfer formula is we all throw this word risk score around, and yes, to a large extent, the PLRS is your risk score of your membership. But if you have a risk score of 1.72, what does that mean for your payment transfer? Absolutely nothing, right? It only matters in regard to what premium you can collect and also what the rest of the market is doing. So yes, we can talk about risk score in the ACA market, but the second very important question is what is your, what we call the relative risk? And Curran's got that pasted on his slides throughout the rest of the presentation. So what is relative risk? Relative risk is just the part inside the brackets. So let's say that inside the brackets, we do this for a market and a metal, and we get a number 0.05 inside. So that's a reasonable number, 0.05. And we multiply that by the premium. So what does 0.05 mean? That's what we are calling our relative risk. That is that indicates a 5% above the market. You have 5% higher risk relative to your competitors in that market. So that means you have worse risk members than you can collect for, and you have worse risk members than your competitors. So relative risk is just the part inside the brackets. It's not a beautiful way of defining it, but it kind of gives you the idea. And that's what you should be asking when, if you're in a risk department, you know, yes, I know what my risk score is, and yes, you definitely want to get this PLRS as high as you can, but when it comes to financial implications, you got to switch gears and start talking about this darn formula and what is your relative risk, what is the inside of the formula mean for you. I think that's it on the payment transfer formula. Any questions? before we move on?
So, not a mathematician. So, is the relative risk score just an assumption?
No, it's not an assumption. It's actually a calculation that you do using all of these terms. So, can you do that at the health plan? No, because you can do the numerator.
Yeah.
You just can't do the denominator. So, what Wakely does as part of this project, this first one, is we calculate it, but basically we're giving you the denominator so you can understand what your relative risk is. Thank you for the question.
Yeah, sorry about this. I'm just trying to understand. So once I know that relative risk, do I take that times my state average premium, and that will tell me what my then transfer actually works out to be?
Right. So this is a... This one actually is not very well defined in the reg, but you take it times the PMPM premium and multiply it times member months, yes.
Okay.
So this is a market-wide, or sorry, this is a state premium. When you take the GCF times it, you get a market premium, so sometimes I say that incorrectly. But yeah, the one on the outside is the statewide premium. All right, so enough of payment transfer formula. Why is it important? So this is just an example. If you haven't seen this a calculation like this before, you've certainly felt this calculation. Payment transfers can add up in a hurry. So this is just an example of how miscoding can actually impact the payment transfer formula. So it's not as easy as Medicare Advantage, right? So Medicare Advantage is you just take that differential in the extra diagnoses and the HCC that you've found, or maybe that was not appropriate to be in there. You take that times the risk-adjusted premium, and there is your very specific impact for that member. Not so easy in the ACA world. In the ACA world, you need all of these components to understand what a change in risk score is going to mean for your plan. One of the things that was really shocking, so I'm a Medicare Advantage person, not a commercial person, but what was really shocking for me is that in the ACA world, a diagnosis can mean, you know, let's say it's a 0.15, whatever, additional risk score bump on a member. So that can mean more dollars in an ACA world than it means in a Medicare Advantage world, which is shocking. It was very shocking to me. But the idea, I mean, there's reasons behind it, and if you want to talk about that, maybe we can take that offline. So I'll stop with my teaching there. But very critical. Each HCC is maybe more important than in a Medicare Advantage world. There's fewer of them. That's one part of the equation. So anyway, you need all of these things in order to understand what a change in risk, what a change in a PLRS is going to do for your plan. So you need the average premium statewide. That's the P on the outside. You need your own issuer score. So this is for a single I, right? So a single metal tier and market. So here's your risk score. Here's the rest of the market average risk score, 0.95. So you can see from the top that you're about 10% greater. This is the market average. So if you weight your own score with the rest of the market, then you can get the market average of the risk score. You need to know what portion of the market you comprise. So in this case, we're 10% of the market, million member months. We have 100,000. So there's a total issuer premium in our market and metal tier of about 45 million. Forgive me for that slight incorrect statement, but you have about 45 million that's used as part of the P in the formula. Our market share, again, is 10%. This right here, this 0.09375, this is the relative risk that I was talking about before. You know, what's your relative risk? You got a risk score that's higher than the market. So our relative risk is 0.09735. So we have higher, so inside the brackets, we have a positive number. So the risk we have is greater than the right-hand side. The risk we have is greater than the premium we can collect. And we're going to get some money coming into the plan. So here we have $4.2 million dollars of risk payment transfer coming into the plan. If you just change this average PLRS score a bit, you can see that it has very large impacts to the risk payment transfer at the end of the year. So very difficult to understand the value of what all you do in the risk adjustment world on the ACA. But I would encourage you to get some actuary or some financial person to kind of run through this for you so you understand, oh, what is another, you know, 0.2 on the risk score for this member? How does that translate to the average risk score for this market and metal tier? Because, yeah, it very soon shows the organization the benefits of what all of you are doing day to day. So I think that's the setup. Curran, over to you for what you can share as far as what we found in some of these studies we've done.
Thank you, Julia. So Julia gave a great summary about how do you convert codes into dollars. The reason why I'm here is I've been working with a lot of plans. In the previous session, we talked about all the reasons why a lot of plans are losing money. And so I've been working with a number of mostly provider-owned plans, trying to get them from the unprofitable to the profitable side. And one of the things that I keep finding is the importance of risk adjustment. So everything that you do with risk adjustment impacts product design, network strategy. If you're in the risk adjustment field, you essentially control everything, and you may not even realize it. So, what I'm going to talk about is how does risk adjustment affect profitability? So connect all the work that you guys do on the risk adjustment side to the bottom line plan financials. So one of the things, you know, let's start with product. So this is 2014 WRI data, Wakely Risk Insight data. It's got the ACA individual market from 2014. And what it's showing is, let's focus on the first set of numbers there. That's net income, but taking into account just the stuff that's going to continue into 2018. So none of the transitional reinsurance stuff in there. And the market on the whole lost money on every single metal level except silver. And we'll talk about why silver is so special. But a lot of the plans looked at that platinum number, the negative 235. That's not any plan's specific number. That's just average across the individual market. That's how much money platinums were losing. And so, you know, so people are looking at that, and we have to make decisions on what to do about, we can impact pricing. Well, can we rate platinum premiums up? No, as actuaries, we've got some limits on how we rate plans by metal level. And essentially, well, I'll talk about that in a second, how our rating restrictions compare to the underlying cost structure. A lot of the plans, you know, the CFOs looked at this and they're like, oh, we should get rid of the platinum product. Well, that's also problematic because if you get rid of the platinum and the market gets rid of your competitors get rid of the platinum, well, what's going to happen to those members? They don't disappear from the market. They just buy the next level down, gold. And essentially, when you do the calculations, your premium scale down, your cost, claim cost scales down, and your risk transfers also scale down. So you've just moved the profitability from platinum into another bucket. And that was very counterintuitive. And this, what I'm showing here is just one example of how we've been slicing and dicing the data, looking at where the profits are, where the losses are. And what's counterintuitive, at least in the ACA market, is risk adjustment came around, and basically the profits and losses traded places with each other from what it used to be before risk adjustment came around. So everything, all the historical relationships that people are used to, the way people are used to thinking about things, it's all changed, and sometimes in so counterintuitive ways. We'll talk about that in a second, too. So I was talking about, you know, Platinum's losing money. Well, why is that? So as actuaries... So that was with reinsurance. So reinsurance kind of helped out the situation a little bit, but, you know, it's not around. It's around in a different form, nowhere to the extent that it's shown over there. So lots of numbers here. I'll just explain what this is in English. As actuaries, we love our numbers. So what we try to do over here is when I'm thinking about profitability, I'm looking at my expenses, and I'm looking at my revenue. So this stuff here, I'm just going to walk up to it. This is my expenses, this column. And the way I've calculated this, I've tried to compare everything to the bronze plan, because that kind of broke even. So what this number, for example, over here is saying is my platinum, expenses on my platinum were 4 times on average the bronze expenses. What do I get on revenue? So my revenue is comprised of 2 things, premiums and risk transfer. Now, risk transfer can be a payable, but I'm thinking about it. The reason why I put it in premiums is I've got my expenses are what they are. As actuaries, I don't have a lot of control over what those expenses are. I have a lot of control over premiums, well, some control over premiums. And then risk adjustment was supposed to come in and bridge the gap between what my expenses are and what I'm allowed to charge. So I've added risk adjustment to premium because it's supposed to make up for everything that I couldn't do on the premium side. But what you see over here is my revenue is only 3 times the bronze revenue. So my expenses are 4 times, but my revenue is only 3 times. So we looked at this and we said, all right, what can we do about it? The only squishy factor that we had, the only control that we had, was this thing called induced demand factor. Induced demand factor is just essentially a behavioral factor. What it's intended to do is it says, well, if you charge somebody, if the member's cost sharing is less for certain services, they're going to go ahead and use more of the services. It's less of a financial deterrent. So it's essentially a utilization adjustment. It's a good way to think about it. The feds, the regulations, you know, suggest these induced demand factors. And risk adjustment, in fact, they use these factors. And what this says is platinum, if a person has a platinum plan, they'll use 15% more services than a bronze. But you don't have to use those factors. You can come up with your own factors. And we looked at this and we said, well, what's the factor that I would need? So this is showing the factor the adjustment I would need to make to the induced demand. So you said 15%, you see 15% here? I needed it to be 50% higher. Well, 30% higher than 15, which is 1.5. I need my platinum to be 50% higher than bronze. So in some states, I review rate filings in certain states, so I looked at factors as high as this, and the regulators allowed that. In most states, they said, well, no, you can't do that. That's not behavioral factors. You've got coding mixed in there. You've got a whole bunch of other things in there. So it goes back to, well, there's not a lot of leverage that I have. There's nothing I can do in terms of pricing other than raise everybody's rate, in which case marketing will say, well, my plan, I can't sell that plan if I raise everybody's rate. I want my bronze to be competitive. So get the bronze down, get the platinums up in terms of premium rates, and that's really hard for actuaries to do. Platinum also gets selected against. That's where you find most of your sick members. And if that's where most of your sick members are, it becomes even more important to code. So you might be, you know, people are looking at this and everybody's getting blamed. Well, the actuary didn't price it right. The coders aren't doing their job. The providers aren't coding. Everybody's getting blamed for it. But there are systemic, part of it is, well, yeah, you can code better, but how much can you code? How much better can you get it? Well, if you did the best job possible, will it make the problem go away? And the system isn't designed to make the problem go away, and which is part of the reason why you're seeing, at least in the individual market, to some extent in the small group market, the platinums disappearing. So let's talk about broad versus narrow network. Why are the broad network plans disappearing from ACA? And how risk adjustment impacts that? I want to go back to one of the first slides and talk about this premium number here. Julia mentioned this was a state average premium. What's the implication of having a state average premium define how much you get paid? Well, if you're lower than the state average premium, the state average premium is not your cost structure. It's nobody's cost structure. There's a low-cost plan, there's a high-cost plan, and it's an average of the two. So for the low-cost plan, they're going to pay or receive based on a number that's higher than their cost structure. A broad network plan, a high-cost plan, is going to get transfers based on a number that is lower than their cost structure. So the fact that it's a market average premium is really important and determines who the winners and losers are. So this is a simplified version of a project that I did for a client. We had a broad network plan that was failing, and it was really hard to get them to a competitive place in the ACA. And what this simulation does is shows really what the broad network plans are up against. And it'll help explain why some of the bigger carriers who don't have narrow network arrangements with providers are exiting the market. So we created what this simulation is showing is this fake marketplace, hypothetical marketplace, with two plans, a broad network plan and a narrow network plan. You can think of the narrow network plan as a provider-owned plan. They've got the exact same membership, exact same market share. They've got the exact same members, same morbidity. Everything's the same. But the narrow network plan, because they've got some steerage into the provider, they get better discounts, so their premiums are a little different. No transfers because there's no difference in risk adjustment. And then I said, all right, what if I throw in a few additional lives into the market, and I'll give them to the broad network plan, and I'll give them to narrow network plan, I'll give it to both of them. Let's just have some fun with it and see what happens. What this shows is a summary of what happens, and we'll go over it. So initially, we started with an 80, and the way I measured what happens is through the, you're all familiar with the term loss ratio taking risk adjustment into account. So we looked at, well, okay, we started with an 80% loss ratio in a world where everybody could price everything perfectly. Then we put about 180 member months into the narrow network plan, and then we put them into the broad network plan. So this, the second and third line show unhealthy lives entering the market. The one thing you'll notice is everybody's loss ratio goes up. Why is that? Well, as actuaries, we have to price to the market average. We have to estimate what the market average is. And with new unhealthy lives entering the market, that means the market average is changing. So we've already screwed up here, right? So when these new, because we didn't estimate the market average morbidity, every plan loses money. And it's not just the plan that gets the unhealthy lives, the other plan also. So in this case, the narrow network plan gets the unhealthy lives. But look at what happens to the broad network plan too. They start losing money, and that's because the risk adjustment starts moving money around. So, and that's why this WINRAR is super important. It helps us estimate what that market average is. And in 2014 and 2015, we had absolutely no idea what the market average was until 2014 data came around and we started, we had a better estimate. So, few observations here. Regardless of where the unhealthy lives go, both plans lose money. We know why that is. But who loses more money? So wherever the unhealthy lives go, that plan loses more money. In this case, the narrow network loss ratio is higher than the broad network plan. When they go to the broad network plan, the broad network loss ratio ended up being higher than the narrow network plan. But you'll notice relative to each other, the broad network plan, in this case, so the worst scenario of all these four numbers is this number right here. So when the unhealthy lives go to a broad network plan, it loses by more than the narrow network plan would lose, right? So let's take a step back. It makes sense. These numbers make sense. A broad network plan has to pay more for the same care than a narrow network plan. So it's going to get hurt more. And then there is, you know, so there's the provider discount issue, but then there's also the risk adjustment issue. So in the risk adjustment, going back to the market average premium, if the broad network plan gets the unhealthy lives, it's getting compensated for it by risk transfers using that lower market average premium. The lower market average premium is not the cost structure that's applicable to the broad network plan. Its cost structure is much higher. So it doesn't get fully compensated in the risk transfers when it's on the receivable side. And when it's on the payable side, it doesn't pay as much into the risk transfer payment. That dynamic is important to understand. When the narrow network plan, so narrow network plan is the opposite. Narrow network plans pay more because it's based off of a higher market average, and they receive more. So you'd want the narrow network plan to be on the receivable side strategically, and the broad network plan on the payable side. Does that sort of make sense? It's kind of complicated. So broad network plan pay, when it's in a payable position, it pays less than what it costs, and the narrow network plan receives more than what it costs to provide the care. So you want the broad network plan paying and the narrow network plan receiving. But what actually ends up happening in the marketplace, and we've seen this anecdotally, we've seen this in client data, unhealthy lives, where are they going to go? They want a choice of providers. They pick the broad network plans. When they pick the broad network plans, it puts the broad network plans on the receivable end, which is the unfavorable position for the broad network plan to be in. And the narrow network plan is paying to the broad network plan. So it pays a greater percentage of its premium, and the broad network plan is not receiving enough compensation. They're both losing. And that's one of the issues that has been plaguing the ACA market and the broad network plans exiting. And there's some other examples over here. You know, what if you take healthy lives? You know, this one is supposed to show that selection, but it's hard to compare it to anything else. Unhealthy lives going to broad network plan and healthy lives going to narrow network plan. And then what happens if healthy lives enter the market? So just to give you a flavor of all the different variations. Going back to the meta level, one of the things that I wanted to study, do you have a question?
Just real quick, I just want to make sure something's clear. So the differential that you've got implied in this calculation between a narrow network and a broad network's pricing is approximately 10%,
yep.
Right?
I don't, yep.
It's not exactly that, but
yep.
Does the differential between those two products in what's being charged, what does that have any effect on the math as far as
yes.
what it, right. So right. if you widen the differential and broad network plans are taking in more than 10% of a premium over narrow network plans, then how does that, I mean, that obviously affects the medical loss ratio calculation, right? Because
right.
you're getting, I think part of the problem in the early years with all this stuff is that premium was too low.
Right.
So the compensation for PLRS is somewhere in like the 150s. Well, now it's 248 per point of PLRS, at least in our state. And that's getting close to where it needs to be in order for it to pay off to have someone with a sick condition on, it seems. So what effect does the differential have, if any, on the calculation and the math?
So in terms of the differential between broad and narrow network, in this case, it's a little bit complicated because if you, the bigger the differential you have, the market share is going to change. So, you know, one of the set of results that I'm not showing here is the bigger differential. If the broad network plan, the members are willing to pay for a broad network plan up to a certain point.
Right.
And then they don't get the market share.
But and they're priced, they're, because of the subsidies.
So if they're not the subsidies, one of the studies that that I looked into is who's getting the market share in the ACA market. It's a low cost. The lower income populations are very, very sensitive to price. If they're always shopping for the lowest cost plan. So the broad network plans aren't getting the market share that they need. And if they're lower, if it's a lower market share, then the risk transfer payment is even more exacerbated. Because it's a plan with a bigger market share that drives the market average and so on and so forth. So,
you sure?
I think
we can. I'd love to talk more about it afterwards too. If you have a question there. So, the point of this chart, again, tons of numbers, but the point of this is I wanted to see, are there systemic differences, but by meta level, by condition? We'll talk about conditions later. What's driving the cost versus risk score relationship? Are some meta levels always over and under compensated for? So what I've shown here is the relative risk score, which Julia talked about, relative risk score. How do you compare to the market average by meta level? And I've split out the CSR, the different CSR levels. And so what this number is showing is my platinum plan, my risk score is 63% higher than the market average, but my cost is 232%. My cost is so much higher than my risk score. Now, risk score could be because, well, we're not doing a good job of coding. It could be because the way the risk score model is calibrated. Remember, the risk score model is calibrated on a different population than individual market. It's calibrated on Truven data, which is mostly employer and large groups. So are there systemic differences? And what the green numbers show is places where we're okay. Red numbers show places where we're not okay. So in terms of platinum, for example, my costs for platinum members is 43% higher than my risk score. For the CSRs, my cost is actually lower than my risk score. And this is something we see when we did the WRI study. CSR, there's not a lot of patterns we saw. I can talk about averages all day, but there's different plans here, and for each of you, those relationships will be different. But one of the relationships we saw consistently was I think the previous session talked about the favorable treatment of low-cost plan. It goes back to the CSRs. So risk adjustment formula has this interesting factor in it. It's called the CSR adjustment. And what it says is, you know, I talked about the behavioral factor, the induced demand. It's got that in the risk adjustment formula too. But it's only got that on the left side. And I'll simplify all of this. But what that means is the model is saying because CSR members have to pay less in cost sharing, they're going to use more services. Well, that's not what we see in the data. They have lower cost sharing because they're low income. A $5 copay for a low income person is the same as a $20 copay for a higher income person. So you don't see them using more services, but risk adjustment treats the plan liability as if it was higher. So the CSRs almost always made money. And I talked about on the previous slide the broad network versus narrow network plan. The low-income population is very price-sensitive. They go into the lowest-cost plan, which are typically your Medicaid low-cost plans. Those plans get the CSR adjustment. And the risk adjustment in ACA is very different from everything else. It's a zero-sum game. So to pay into the CSR, you have to take money from everybody else. And guess where the money is coming from? It's coming from those broad network plans. So the broad network plans get a double whammy. They're not getting the CSR adjustment, the risk transfer, you know, they're getting selected against. They're not getting, and when they're selected against, the risk transfer is not compensating them enough. So CSRs and risk, the selection works a little bit to offset each other. CSR will cause the broad network plans to pay, and the selection effects, because they get selected, that means they get receivables, but they're not getting as much as they should because of the CSR adjustment. Sort of make sense? Yeah, there's a question over there.
I'm sorry, I forgot what I was going to say. I'm familiar with the idea that the induced utilization factors for CSR reward CSR plans more than they should, mm-hmm. because the idea is that these very low-income people are not as sensitive to the changes in price. If you take their copay from $10 to $5, doesn't necessarily going to mean they're going to utilize
right.
more. Now, based on the theory that I just outlaid and you described, wouldn't it hold that at the higher AV level, 94%, we would see that discrepancy be larger? So when we see in your graph there at the 73%, there's minus 7%. Then at 87, there's 34%. Would not we also expect the 94% level to be of a greater magnitude, maybe 35 to plus? I didn't know if you had any insight into or theories as to why that's the case.
That's actually a really good question, and I've been scratching my head. Because, I mean, what this shows over here is not profitability. It's just trying to compare risk scores to cost. But when I looked at the profitability by the CSR, I didn't see that relationship. But I don't have a theory for why that is. So you're saying 94%, the gap between my risk transfer and cost should be wider than 73%. And
yes.
73% should look more like the standard silver. I don't have a theory. I've been wondering that for a while myself. But great question.
Can I venture a guess at that?
Yeah.
It might be that the relative values of the subsidized plans, the 94%, so that basically effectively about a 6% liability for the member versus 13% versus 27%, might not be in line with the resulting premium that those members pay. So it might not be in line with the risk scores. I'm kind of losing my thought here, but it's not necessarily in line. Those are just dictated. These are what the percentages need to be. And it might not be relative to their relative wealth. That's what I'm trying to say. So they're lower income people. As you go to the 94, you know, and 87, not quite as low income, 73, not quite as low income.
Right.
Their relative disposable income might not be in line
right.
with the AVs that are here. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's a great comment.
They're going to yell at me anyway, but I think you're absolutely right. And the only thing I would add to that is, remember, all these people, they might have small income and their premiums and the co-pays, the co-shares might be correctly adjusted to that income. But most, what I've learned is a lot of people also have relatives, fathers, sons, that maybe have much better income. So what they're going to do is they're going to give their aunt $50 to go and get this service delivered, to get their health
right.
problems. So that whole thing, it's a good reason why this happens, but that whole pricing and co-share system that's meant to equalize, people's cost of care with their incomes kind of gets broken down by the fact that they have relatives, loved ones, and networks that'll say, here's $100, go get done what you need done. And that's my best guess. Okay. All right. But okay.
Yeah.
Well, because within each CSR level, there's a 50% of FPL band. If I'm understanding you correctly, it would be interesting to add to this chart the average FPL rate within each CSR level. For instance, at 73%, maybe it's smack dab in the middle of that 200 to 250 at 225%. But then when we go to the 94%, who knows, instead of being smack dab in the middle of the 100 to 150 and being at 125, maybe it's at 101, and that may impact the level of true induced utilization.
I think it really boils down to their disposable income after they pay for their rent and their groceries and everything else. And these are low-income people. So relative in each tier, yeah, they could be on the other end. But it's also not just their absolute, like, income. It's also take out their average expenses and what's left to pay for medical costs.
Right.
So that's – and that's not easy to quantify. But that could be why these seem a little wonky.
Yeah. I mean, that's the level of detail that in claim data that I get. And this is obviously from enrollment data, but I don't have income data. And it would be great to study that, but you know, that's just information that I don't think any health plan has that information either. Sorry, what was that?
We can back into it using the APTC.
Right, for those three levels. Or... Oh, I see what you're saying. That's a good point. Right. That's a great point. I should look into that, actually. I never thought about that. This chart, again, drives home the CSR point. So what I wanted to look at were, are certain conditions in HCCs, you know, are your hierarchical condition categories in the risk adjustment model, are certain whether the condition was profitable or not depended on, to some extent, the metal level that the person was in. So the green bars show that for CSR, so everything to the right of this line that I'm trying to draw with my laser, this stuff is profitable, this stuff is not profitable, and what I'm trying to measure here is how many conditions are profitable. So in this case, the green bars are how many conditions are profitable in a CSR plan, and the red bar is the standard silver, and the blue bar is all other metal levels combined. And I combined them because there wasn't a big difference between bronze and gold and platinum. For all of them, it seemed like most conditions were not profitable, if you look at the blue. But then you look at the green, and most of the green is concentrated on the right side. Just about every condition was profitable. To varying degrees, if your member was in a CSR plan. This chart, so now I'm studying, so I study things by meta level. Now I'm trying to study, are certain conditions more profitable than others? And this doesn't show everything, but I just took some examples out to show. I'm showing relative risk scores, just the same as before, relative cost, so compared to the average, what's the risk score for everybody with diabetes, and what's their cost, and then I'm just comparing the two numbers here. But now remember, from Julia's presentation, your risk score is not 100% linked to your transfers. Your transfers could be anything else, completely different, because it's based off of a market average premium. So you could have a high. You could have a situation like you see over here, where your cost is 24% less than the risk score. So technically, you should be making money on the diabetics, but cost relative to risk transfers, you're not getting enough risk transfers. The payment that you get from the risk adjustment is not enough, and this is on average. So if you looked at your data, if everyone went back and looked at their data, you're going to come with completely different results. But there is an interesting pattern here. Look at what's in the red. The red is where my cost is higher than the risk score, and my transfers are inadequate compared to my cost. So we've got pregnancy. We've got hepatitis, HIV, and members with no HCCs. I thought these were very interesting, and here's why. In the individual market, pregnancy is one of the is something you can predict. You can that is something that if you're going to get pregnant, you know you should buy a health plan. So there is a selection factor associated with pregnancy. Hepatitis, on the other hand, that had a new drug come out, the Sovaldi that everybody's been talking about for the last 2 years. The risk adjustment model wasn't calibrated for those costs. So hepatitis risk adjustment was nowhere near. Your risk score was nowhere near what the costs were. HIV, AIDS, no theories there. I don't know if there were new drugs that were released or what was there. I'm going to talk about more on this in the next few slides. That's very interesting because the no HCC category, that's 80% of your market. 80% of the people in the individual market don't have any coded conditions. And plans tend to lose money on them. So this graph is showing profitability by the number of chronic conditions. This was interesting to me because, I mean, this goes to show how the historical relationship between profitability and morbidity have completely changed in the ACA market. For plans, sicker people used to be, by definition, unprofitable, and it's all the healthy people that were paying for the sicker people. So you, what this is showing in the orange bars are your net income, your profitability. The blue line is showing the claim cost, and the silver, the gray stuff, is showing the risk transfers. So you'll see the risk transfers track claim costs pretty closely, but they're almost higher than the claim costs. So the higher up you go in morbidity, the more money on average plans were making. And part of the reason for that is the risk adjustment model wasn't calibrated for reinsurance. So you got reinsurance payments, plans have private reinsurance, there's the federal reinsurance, and there was a bias when, in our discussions with CMS, when they were talking about setting up the risk adjustment model, they had a little bias towards overcompensating on the higher morbidity side. Two other important things to note here. There are some, at least based on what I've seen, there are some really good vendors out there who work in this segment over here. The very, very sick. They'll come in and they'll manage the top 5%. It's mostly in Medicare. They'll manage the top 5% risk, the sickest of the sickest. And they'll go in, do home visits. They'll take full risk on it. They'll improve the coding. I've seen positive ROI on those activities. So not a lot of people are talking about that in the ACA market. If you can turn this, the point I'm trying to make here is figure out where you're making money and where you're losing money. The strategy can be to reduce the losses where you're losing money, but maybe make more profits where you are actually making money. So that's this group over here where a lot of plans are actually making money. And then this zero conditions, that's interesting. It's hard to see here, and I'll show it on this slide. Members with no HCCs, most plans on average are losing money on them because you pay out risk transfers. If you don't have any condition coded, you're essentially writing a check to people who have conditions or to your competitor. So a lot of plans are talking about, well, we need more healthy people. Everybody's talking about these healthy people, younger people who want to enter the market. Because of risk adjustment, we have to think harder whether those transitionals and healthy people coming into the market will actually solve your problem. Especially if you have all the transitionals and those transitionals come 2018 are going to migrate into your ACA block and you have the dominant market share on those healthy people, you might be cutting a check to your competitors. And so you have to factor that into your pricing. So I mean, the chart over here just basically makes the point. It shows you shows the profitability by age groups. So on younger people, we're losing money, and the way we can see that is the gray line is my premium. I can rate more for older ages. My yellow line is the claim cost, and premium plus risk transfers is below my premium line because I'm paying out on every single one of these members. So it brings my revenue down on all the healthy members. And this is just focusing on people with no HCCs. But as you go up in ages, look at what happens to my revenue versus expense equation. Right around age 50, my revenues overtake my expenses. And on average, people are making money on the older folks. That's, again, very counterintuitive. People are not used to thinking about the individual market like that. You're getting a lot of plans were getting overcompensated by the risk adjustment on the older population. And there is an opportunity to think about, if you're in the Medicare Advantage, for example, to think about what are we going to do? Is there an opportunity to market Medicare Advantage plans to these people? Yep.
I was just going to ask if you've done any analysis about the change in the HSEX weights going into 2017. I think CMS is aware that non-HCC members were not profitable. And what they said is that they wanted to incorporate the cost for those wellness visits so that all of the no-HCC members will get a bump up. And I didn't know if you've done any analysis to look at how the issue here with those no-HCC members being unprofitable might be ameliorated as we walk into 2017.
That's an excellent point. So we're actually looking at that right now. We've done analysis. This is now public. But State of Nevada was very interested in a lot of the conversations that are going on right now are about pushing the control back to states. So State of Nevada wanted to look at how their age factors line up and if they should be focusing on changing the age factors. And what we found was changing the age factors. It's a state-by-state thing. So in Nevada, what we found was it wasn't really going to help the plans that much to change the age factors. But generally speaking, if you're talking about the child age factors, that's a good thing. So creating more separation, you know, the 0.635 or whatever was the factor for 0 to 20, I think the new regulations allow more variation, and that's generally a good thing. It's good in the case where you get a different mix of children compared to the rest of the market. Because remember, everything is based on how you compare to the rest of the market. So if you have the exact same mix, then you're okay. So, yep.
So a lot of this, I think, is an argument about the coefficients for the HCCs. And it looks like this is 2014 data.
Yep.
So would a lot of these trends still hold true for 2016?
Mm-mm. The coefficients have changed.
Yeah.
The coding has improved. There's just so many changes that a lot of these relationships. The point I'm trying to make is how much risk adjustment has changed the relationships. You can't take a look at this and say,
yeah,
oh my gosh, I should be marketing to older people.
Yeah.
That's not the point I'm trying to make. I mean, in fact, the point is the exact opposite. It's older people have now become profitable. You got to look at your own data, figure out where the buckets of profitability are. And I mean, we can model the changes. We can model things like if your age gender coefficients are changing, if the rating is changing. We can model all of that and figure out how the profitability will change going forward.
Yeah, and you got to stay on top of it year after year after year with all the changes.
Okay. Right. The thing that's harder to I have to ask are the person who does most of the risk adjustment, the coding improvements from year to year. How is that changing? Right. And are those coding improvements more focused in certain population segments, like platinums? If platinums were getting selected against, how is it going to impact, does it impact platinum more than it impacts bronze? Or is it level throughout all the metal levels? Does it impact older ages more than the younger ages and things like that? I think I'm forgetting a point I wanted to make here that was important, but I'll come back to it if it comes back to me. One of the things that I was getting a lot of phone calls from at least one person who believed that rural areas were subsidizing urban areas because of risk adjustment. That might be true in that particular state, but I looked nationally to see if there was a systemic flow of money from rural to urban or urban to rural. I didn't see that, or at least it wasn't very big. What this is showing is just relative risk by we took all the rating areas, we flagged them into urban, rurals, urban or rural or mixed, and then we looked at the risk transfers by rating area in 2014 and 2015. And urban was paying out, rural was paying out, but it's a very small amount, and it was actually flowing into the mixed areas. So again, it may not be true of your state, but at least nationally, we didn't see the trends that risk adjustment was disadvantaging rural versus urban. Now, that might not be true if you're the premium differential in your state. The way to judge that is looking at the premium differential. If rural areas are less expensive than urban areas and the market average is in between, depending on whether the healthy members are concentrated in rural versus urban, there might be that flow. You know, going back to the broad versus narrow network conversation, there might be a flow of money there. Another argument that I heard was the bigger the plan, you know, they do a great job. I'll start with this and then come back. The bigger plans are getting selected against, or the smaller plans are getting selected against. So we looked at relative risk by market share. And this is 2015 now. So again, no patterns here. Your lower market share, higher market share, and relative risk, at least for the plans that we studied, it was all over the place. And within, if you looked at the data within this, there was a huge variation from high to low. So I'm just showing averages because I can't actually show you plan level data. But at least I didn't see anything that correlated market share with whether you were high risk or low risk. And what this shows, over here I wanted to study whether if your market share changed from 1 year to the next, is there a corresponding change in your risk score? And that's where we saw some pattern, which was interesting. Plans who lost market share from 14 to 15, their relative risk compared to the state average went up, but plans with who gained market share, their risk score went down. I don't have any theories to that. It could be because, you know, your coding is going to be not perfect in the first year. Maybe they're getting unhealthy people. Maybe the transitionals are flowing in. There's any number of things that could be happening here.
I would just guess it's restating the broad network, narrow network dilemma in another way. As broad networks realize they have to up their price to try to remain competitive,
right,
their market shares go down, and it just plays out in this slide here. But hey,
that's
just
actually
a
very good point. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Ask me how I know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the end of the presentation. If you have any questions, any further questions.
Do you know when Wakely's going to release its RINRAR, the Wakely Risk Insight results for 2015? I know Syed kind of pushed back some of the deadline for submitting data.
Yeah,
so
we had some late new entrants that were very important to include. So the last I heard, I don't have a date. I have my clients asking the same question. And the original deadline was end of February, but I think it might be pushed into March. But I don't have a definitive date. Okay, well, thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.